All right. Can you do a sound check for me?
That is an awesome book that is called All Cats Have Asperger's Syndrome. I see it there.
Have you never... Pull that mic closer to you.
I have never seen this book before. Look at the cuteness of this kitty, too, on the cover.
I got that book. My professor at St. Rose for our emotional behavior disorders course recommended that book because it was a very interesting and quote-unquote very interesting comparison. It does a great job of explaining autism and Asperger's to children that might be recently diagnosed. I'm like, oh cool, cats, Asperger's, that's right up my alley. I got the book and I did not realize it was just going to be a straight up picture book about like sometimes like pick a page and read it.
Preferring squishy places to a hug.
And that's why all cats have Asperger's.
Yeah, but none of this is true. I mean,
it is.
Cats love their humans. I mean, my...
So what it's saying is it's okay to sometimes want distance and not always want people to touch you.
I'm like outraged that she's giving cats a bad name.
No, it's great.
I mean, I'm kidding. It's so... I mean, it's really cute.
Yeah.
Extra adventurous with no sense of danger. Love that. This is adorable.
Yeah. And that, ladies and gentlemen, leads us into our episode with Dr. Deb Rutledge, PT extraordinaire, yoga teacher extraordinaire, and lover of All Cats Have Asperger Syndrome by Kathy Hoopman.
Well, really just all cats.
Fair enough.
All cats.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, I think I've been asking you for 2 months to come on now.
Probably.
Something like that.
Sounds right.
So I don't know where we even want to start. You have experience in high levels of physical therapy, physiotherapy?
Here we say physical.
Physical therapy. You helped me walk in a straight line again, which was an experience. Some of the most pain that I've ever been in was thanks to you. You have led some phenomenal yoga courses from beginner to advanced. You helped lead what was the aspect of the yoga teacher training that you were instructing?
I taught the anatomy and physiology, and I consulted with posture clinic,
which is no small feat. I think most people in any fitness industry really doesn't understand body mechanics.
Correct.
That I've seen.
Correct.
What's it like working with people that have zero experience with it? And with comparing to your level of understanding?
I think the biggest challenge from my end of it is to determine what is most important to understand. And versus trying to give all of the knowledge. Does that make sense?
To me, that makes sense because I'm a teacher, but I don't think people outside of that will know.
So, when I first started the yoga teacher training, teaching the anatomy and physiology, I was, let's identify every muscle, let's talk about it, all the thing. It's a very overwhelming amount of information, and I need that information as a physical therapist. Certain physicians need that information to do their job, but we have 3 and 4 years to get comfortable with that information and using that information and talking about that information. People in the exercise industry, I'm just gonna talk about it like that, get 20, 30, 40 hours to get comfortable with that information. standard yoga teacher training is, or introductory level yoga teacher training is 200 hours, but only anatomy and physiology is only one piece of that. There's many other aspects as well that all have to come into play. So figuring out what is most important and what is, are things that can be learned later, was the first challenge. And I made a lot of mistakes when I first started teaching. I was probably extremely overwhelming when I first started teaching. And eventually I learned over a few years, I learned that what was most important was to teach and understand body mechanics. Looking up the name of muscle, you can look that up in 30 seconds on Google these days. You can look that up in a book. You don't need to store that in your brain.
It's almost too easy. It's almost unfortunately easy to get that access.
Right. So teaching somebody to memorize every single muscle in the body is useless and pointless, especially when you don't know how the body moves. I think the way that anatomy is taught is we think, well, we'll teach the words first, we'll teach the jargon first, and then it'll be clear. But we never quite progress to the part where we talk about the physics of motion, which body mechanics essentially is. And so what I came around to was that teaching body mechanics was more important than anything else. Like training people in how to look at the way that somebody moves and see patterns of movement.
And that's going to be more accessible for your students to take in. Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of people get overwhelmed, like you're saying, with the verbiage, and then almost get upset with, like, in teachers trying to be overly academic with them.
Right.
And they take offense to it.
Right.
So, yeah.
Learning how to identify patterns of movement, I think, has become really important to me as a yoga teacher in my physical therapy life, in my own personal yoga practice. Some patterns are beneficial. Some patterns are pathological, meaning they lead to injury or they lead, And so the first you have to identify the patterns, then you have to be able to determine which ones are beneficial and useful and which ones are going to lead to pathology or are the result of pathology. And then work to bring those pathological patterns to a realm that then becomes functional and useful. And that's it.
No, I mean, that makes perfect sense. And, the reason I'm asking that kind of question is because a lot of the people that listen to our podcast and a lot of the people that have been on our podcast are athletes in one avenue or another. And something we've all talked about is how serious our injury was and how... I'm only just now getting back into jiu-jitsu seriously after about two and a half years because of how bad my hip was. I would complain to you all the time. My shoulder was terrible. And that's a running thing, but it can be very discouraging working with some PTs, some chiros, because they diagnose you and then tell you what's wrong and then kind of overwhelm you. And I've got a okay understanding of a lot of that stuff, and even I have a hard time working with it. So with athletes, I think we don't really take care of ourselves as well as we should, because we can Google it, but Googling does so much. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have people maybe not talking down to us, but not making the information accessible.
Right. And there also is, I think, a difference between an insidious injury and a traumatic injury. So an insidious injury is one that creeps up on you. It develops over time. And when you think back, you go to the doctor and you say, my hip hurts. And the doctor says, well, what happened? And your response is, well, I don't know. It's just really kind of been hurting for a while. It just seems to have gotten really bad lately. Well, when did it start? I don't really know. That's an insidious injury. It's developed over time with these, by virtue of these movement patterns that are not as functional as we want them to be.
Yeah.
As we hope that they are. And they're much harder to deal with than a traumatic injury is. A traumatic injury in some ways is easier for our mind to grasp because there's a direct cause and effect, right?
Yeah.
I fell down the stairs, I broke my hip. It's a little bit more cut and dry. It's also easier to understand from a rehab perspective, right? I had this trauma, this was the injury, now I can rehab this injury. But when you have these kind of insidious overuse injuries, they're it's just like so much more nebulous, if I can use that word.
You can. I would like you to explain the word, because I'm not sure what you mean.
So, give me a sec. I gotta get my thoughts together.
By all means.
So, let's take your hip, for example.
Yes.
Talk to me about, like, let's pretend that you've come to see me in a consultation about your hip.
Oh, yeah, because we've never done this. Yeah, so my hip's just, there's this shooting pain. I get out of bed in the morning after 20 minutes of struggling to do so, and then I walk around for 5 minutes, and then I don't feel the pain again until I get out of my desk chair at the end of the day. You know, I can do X, Y, and Z heavy lift, no problem. You know, I think at the time I hurt my hip, I was doing 100-pound Turkish get-ups, but I couldn't swing. I couldn't do a 25-pound kettlebell swing.
Right. How long have you been experiencing this pain getting out of bed and when you stand up?
You know, I've always had some minor aches and pains in the morning, and then one day just kind of worse, and I don't know really what happened or why it changed. And then, you know, I'll do half my workout fine, try one thing, and then I'm on the floor in pain.
Right. So that's where it's nebulous.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying? I can do, out of 10 things, I can do 7 of them consistently, no pain, no problem. 3 of them, or 2 of them, I can do sometimes. I can't pinpoint why. These 8 and 9 I can do sometimes and not other times, or sometimes I can do them and sometimes they cause excruciating pain, other times they just get kind of sore, feel tight, and then 10 I can never do. That's what I mean by kind of nebulous. It's different from every time I step on my right foot.
So it's a gray area.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
No, that makes sense.
Or like, I sit in a chair, I stand up. After how long? After 5 minutes? After 2 hours?
Yeah.
After 10 hours? Those are very different scenarios when we're talking about functional movement patterns.
And I think that's exactly where I was getting frustrated with previous PTs and some chiros, because it wasn't until I interacted with you for physical therapy and then... Justin, I don't know if I'm saying his last name right, Lucia. I think he's out of Georgia now. Where I had people not asking me what I did, but what, like, how, what level of pain are you experiencing this movement versus this movement? Like, how often is it happening? You know. So, but prior to working with you guys, I would just get frustrated and
if not discontinue going to the therapy, then certainly not engaging in the homework.
Right.
I actually had one physical therapist that said, oh, you're clearly very strong, so I don't want you to do any homework exercises.
What?
Yeah. So, like, any of the... So there, I was expecting to go home with, like, a booklet of, you know, lower core ab strengthening exercises and some mobility stuff. She's like, yeah, just hang your leg off the bed at the end of the day so you kind of stretch out your hip flexor.
I wish you all at home could see my
And, you know, I would leave the sessions with her feeling better, but I would have to go every week. And I think that's, you know, a mindset that I have to imagine, you know, well, I see it all the time. You know, I'm 32 now. I lived through ignoring sound advice, and now I'm seeing new generations of athletes that are ignoring sound advice. What kind of, like, mentalities have you seen? Because was I one of the few athletes you saw, or did you see a lot of athletes? And I use the term athlete loosely.
At one point in my career, I did work in an orthopedic office where I did see more what we would call walkie-talkies in the clinic. So people who were outpatient basis, walking around. As opposed to other points in my career where I worked in a nursing home or when I worked in the school for developmentally delayed children. So those, you know, very different perspectives. So the answer is you are not the only athlete that I've ever worked with. But the vast majority of my PT career was in neuro rehab.
Mm-hmm. So we're definitely going to explore that at some point, but I want to hear a little bit about working with, and I use the term athlete loosely because I know you've worked with people that do yoga, you know, yogis, you've worked with runners, lifters. Can you talk about some of the mindsets and like how you've either convinced patients to move past a certain mindset or seen them work past things?
So, it's all about connecting with the person that you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
If I don't get you as my patient to get the buy-in,
yeah,
it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how skilled I am. It doesn't matter how much knowledge I have. You're not going to do the follow-up that you need to do. And you're ultimately not going to get better. Or maybe you'll get better for a while and it'll reoccur. Right? And we've all had those situations with a medical practitioner. You just kind of leave feeling like that guy only wants to hear himself talk. That individual didn't listen to me. I feel like, I don't know what medical school that one graduated from, but...
Oh, God, I can't... It's too bad that Chad's not here today because... Him and I have both vented significantly about how dumb some, maybe not actually remedial, but medical professionals are.
Right. So being able to really connect with the person that is sitting across from you in the exam room is where it starts. Building that relationship is huge. I think many of the people that I've worked with were coming to me after years of being disappointed or having an experience that wasn't quite what they were looking for. And coming to me with my perspective as a dancer, a yogi and a physical therapist, my perspective is very functional based. I want to look at the whole person.
Yeah.
I want to look at your movement patterns. I want to look at how this injury really affects your life, right? Because I may have 10 out of 10 pain when I go and bend down to pick up my cat, but I can do everything else in the rest of my day without much of a problem. And many medical professionals would be like, it's not picking up your cat.
Yeah.
And that to me would be heartbreaking. Like, that wouldn't work for me at all. And that's the piece that you have to address. What is meaningful for you as the patient? And how can I use the knowledge that I have, offer you assistance in a way that is meaningful for your life? And that's what a functional approach to medicine really is. I learned that in my neuro life as a therapist. I learned that from working with developmentally delayed children.
Yeah. It's interesting because we just had on Matt, who owns ABC Fitness, who he runs, we just had him on Friday and I don't remember now, but he runs a program out of his gym for the International Special Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
You know about?
I know. So I have a colleague who, she and her husband are ABC Fitness members,
mm-hmm.
and know the owner very well. They run a dog rescue, but
yeah.
They do a lot of work with Special Olympics through ABC. So I know kind of it.
Yeah, yeah. And he was saying how prior to working with the Special Olympic athletes, he almost had a sense of pity prior, and then working with them, it became a sense of admiration.
Mm-hmm.
And it really impacted how he would address things in his own life and address things with others.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would love to hear about that on your end.
So, there's this exercise called a long arc quad.
Sure.
Have you ever done one?
Maybe.
You probably have. You sit in a chair and you kick your leg out straight.
Okay.
Okay. It's very.
We call that a leg extension.
Okay. Well, it is a very standard physical therapy strengthening rehab exercise, right? For the lower extremity.
Legs. for those at home not familiar with lower extremities.
So. You are a patient of mine.
Yes.
I want to strengthen your legs, right? I can have you sit in a chair. I can put a 5-pound ankle weight on your ankle, and I can have you do however many long arc quads. Does that mean that you're going to be able to stand up from that chair and get yourself to the bathroom?
Probably not.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between meaningful, functional training and I want to say bullshit. That's what wants to come out of my mouth.
No, yeah, absolutely.
But what is meaningful to the individual? If anyone has ever not been able to get themselves to the bathroom, you know how meaningful being able to stand up and go to the bathroom on your own is.
Sure.
It's very similar, I would imagine, with the experience that the ABC, what's his name? The ABC Sports Fitness guy?
Oh, Matt. His
Matt.
Last name.
We can just say Matt. I would imagine it was very similar to his experience working with some of these individuals. They are so elated to be able to do things that we see, take for granted. And I think when we're talking about the mindset of an athlete, a lot of the way that we are trained as athletes, I think, is flawed.
Matt Donaghy, and I'm very sorry, Matt. Please forgive me.
I think the way that we think about training athletes is flawed as well. We're trained to It's like better, faster, stronger, more is what's valued. And that's not always good.
That makes sense.
I had, so we have a mutual friend, Kate.
Yes.
And she, over the summer, spent about a week in Chicago, a few days in Chicago. Maybe.
I imagine it was for baseball.
Softball.
Softball, excuse me.
But she was at this really cool facility where they're looking at throwing, pitching, and they have a belt with sensors that they put on the girl's waist, and they videotape them throwing, and they look at pelvic mobility in relation to a pitch.
Yeah.
They look at how the ankles are moving in relation to a pitch before they even get up to the arm and the shoulder and see what the mechanics of the shoulder are. And that's amazing. That's
well, because that's kind of preemptively nixing issues with compensation, right?
Or yes, but then also looking at, well, you might, yes, correct. Self-edit.
So I just said it way simpler than it should have been, and we had to dumb it down for myself, basically. But yeah, no, it's, but so what's it like in terms of working with those with cognitive disabilities in Special Olympics?
Because, so the incremental, I don't want to say that the expectation, it's just a different expectation.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily care if Jane Doe, who's in my rehab facility, who's had a stroke, who's not able to, hasn't been able to walk since her stroke, I don't really care if she has the most beautiful gait pattern to get herself to the bathroom. I care that she was able to stand up and get there. That's the win. It's a win the first time it happens.
Yeah.
It's a win the 10th time it happens, and by the 300th time it happens, now it's a generalized skill that I know that she's going to be able to do at any point in time. Once we've reached that, then we can look at, okay, let's make this gait pattern more efficient so that you're not, you know, wasting more energy. But she's elated, her family member's elated, I'm elated, because this is huge.
Yeah.
This is something we weren't sure was ever going to happen again, right? And very similar with a developmental population. I don't care that it's beautiful. I care that it happens. I care about the sense of pride.
Yeah.
That you got from being able to do that skill. That's what's important.
No, that's perfect, because I think we get so caught up on crossing the finish line and making mm-hmm. things absolutely perfect that I know I absolutely derailed some of my progress because I wouldn't just enjoy how far I came, and then I overdid it and ended up hurting myself again in different pathways. So that's an interesting commentary, because that leads me to what I wanted to ask next about the connection between the mind and the body. You know, a lot of us have been injured or have needed functional support, but it's really the mentality that stops people dead in their tracks. Like, I'm fortunate in that I have a mindset of go, 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 no matter what. So, you know, to some end, it was not beneficial because it made me exacerbate certain injuries by trying to ignore them or compensate for them. But a lot of people, the second they have notable pain or dysfunctional patterns, stop. I've seen it a ton. I have to imagine between dancing and yoga, and shortly PT, that you've seen it a ton. Like, that mindset is really a killer. So having gone into yoga after PT, right? Or alongside it? Bit of both. They both happened.
Yeah. Interwoven thread, I would say.
And so, in earnest or not, yogis profess having a deep mind-body connection. So can you tell us a little bit about that, where not just in relation to pain and injury, but helping the body through helping the mind and vice versa? Because I think you're in a unique position where you have that clinical aspect and the yoga training.
Yeah.
So that, science versus spiritual aspect.
Right.
And you have a ton of Eastern medicine training. Fair amount.
I have a knowledge of Eastern medicine. I don't know about how.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I think the first thing that I would really highlight is the extreme mental and emotional toll that pain has on an individual. And I feel like it's something that's not really well considered when we talk about pain and pain management. We think about pain from an aspect of being able to do things, right?
How do you mean?
Like,
because in my mind, pain is pain, but I don't know.
Okay, I have a shoulder injury, and opening a cabinet and getting something that's on a high cabinet overhead.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not.
It's insult to injury.
I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
Right? Or I've been told by my doctor not to do that because I have to heal and it hurts. And
right.
And when I don't do that, it doesn't hurt. And it's fine. So I'm not going to do that. However, I am. Hypothetical scenario. I'm a single mother. I have two young kids. I have to feed them. I have to be able to get plates out of the cabinet, and every time I do that it hurts. I don't have any other option except for to continue to do that. I have to help them get dressed. I have to help them get ready for school. My doctor is telling me not to use this limb this way, but I don't really have any other choice, any other option. So now I'm being told that I'm in a situation where I'm non-compliant with my plan for healing, because I'm refusing to follow the doctor's advice, when the reality is, it's the advice and the way of thinking that's flawed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So imagine being in that situation, the amount of stress that being in pain would cause that individual, just day after day after day after day after day after day. It's, you mentally break down. It spirals so many people into depression.
Yeah.
There's very little information on pain and depression. We know that people who are on medications for depression, many of those medications are also now being prescribed for pain management, especially neurological pain.
Oh, I didn't know that.
We find that there's a correlation there. Think about when you are exhausted.
Yeah.
When you get out of bed and you just feel the weight of the world sitting on you, and everything is hard. It's hard to put your shirt on. It's hard to stand up because you just feel so heavy and weighted. people who have chronic pain feel that mentally in addition to the physical pain that they feel, in addition to the loss of control that they have over their lives. I mean, it's they're part and parcel of the same entity.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. So, I don't even know how I want to ask this. You know, you mentioned that some prescriptions for mental health disorders are now being utilized for pain management, or...
They have a secondary effect, many of them, for pain, yeah.
Yeah.
And the reason why I say that is because, listeners, I have a neurological pain condition with my herniated discs and the pressure that one of the discs puts on the nerves in my right arm. And after a year of dealing with this pain and trying to figure it out, I was really in a very dark, depressed place. Many aspects of my life were being challenged, and I had to redefine many things as a result of my situation.
Yeah.
When I spoke with my doctor, my general practitioner, I went on an antidepressant medication, and one of the secondary side effects of the antidepressant was dealing with some of the neurological pain and some of the headaches that I was getting from the muscular tension associated with pain.
No, that makes a ton of sense, because I actually, at one point, I had a resolved heart condition where not only did it cause an irregular heart rhythm for extended periods of time, but because of that, I couldn't take certain medications. So in my path for mental health and trying different medications, there were a limited number of options. I couldn't take SSRIs. The antidepressant I was on, we couldn't increase the dose because it would increase the likelihood of seizures. So to find a mild anxiety medication, they actually prescribed me gabapentin, which is for nerve pain, right?
Originally, gabapentin was prescribed for seizures.
Okay.
Way back.
Yeah.
In the day, like when it was first developed, and now they're finding that gabapentin is great for neurological pain, as well as
anxiety. So, yeah, that was. So this was also around the time I was still dealing with my hip pain. So when it was prescribing me for anxiety, they were telling me, like, you know, you might even get a bonus and have reduced hip pain. It didn't really help with either, but, you know, not a medication
for
everybody.
Anxiety or your hip pain?
Neither, really. I have a very mild case of anxiety that's more in relation to my autism and my ADHD than it being the primary condition, so medications for anxiety are not really ideal for me.
Right.
But it was interesting, you know?
I mean, I guess on some
and
level...
And Ritalin was actually an appetite suppressant before it was for ADHD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, on a certain level, and again, not a neuroscientist, so very cursory understanding here, but it makes a lot of sense, right? Our neurological system runs every aspect of our being. So pain, circulatory function, motor function, even the way that we interpret information coming in and meeting our own being is all governed by our neurological system. So if you are looking to influence the way that that system works, I mean, SSRIs are all about the chemicals that are secreted in the nerve synapse space. So you're basically either increasing the production of, if I remember correctly, so nobody quote me on this, but you're either giving the body the tools to secrete more of a chemical that's going to either slow down or speed up the nerve synapses, depending on what you want to do. Hmm.
It's a deeper understanding of what I had, where it makes my brain receive serotonin, which makes me less sad.
That's what all of those drugs do. Changes the chemistry of the brain so that certain neurological functions work better or work less, depending on what the ultimate end goal is. So if you are altering the brain chemistry, wouldn't it make sense that the entire neurological system would function?
No, it makes perfect sense. And I mean, I think we're... the two of us are nerding out a little bit on the actual practicality of it, but in essence, it's creating a... what's good for the mind is good for the body and vice versa. And especially over here in the West, you know, we don't treat... and that's why Chad and I really got into this. Like, we don't treat mental health the way we treat physical health. But it's not even about treating them separately. They're connected. You know, every athlete Chad and I have ever, you know, trained with has been injured at some point, and they had the choice of sitting in it and wallowing in it or doing something physical to kind of keep them motivated and keep them going. And yes, there was still some frustration and depression associated with being injured, but you know, anytime we have a teammate or a training partner who's hurt, we push them to, like, you know, come, like my coach was always saying, you know, you don't have to, you know, spar, you don't have to roll, come do the drills, you know, at least you're on the mat.
Right.
I did not take the advice, which made it so much harder for me to feel confident in going back to jiu-jitsu. But in hindsight, I see now that that would have been amazing for my mental health. And it would have probably helped me facilitate healing, too, because I would have... I'd be able to gauge where my progress was. Instead of constantly saying, oh, I'm hurt, I could have been saying, oh, I'm hurt, but this is what I can do. And
right. This
is what I could do yesterday, but not today. And going from there.
Right.
Is that a mindset that you developed through the PT or the yoga? Because I want to hear, we talked a lot about the science of your PT background, but I want to hear a little bit about the ideologies and, you know, we'll say, quote-unquote, science of yoga and what you've done with that. That was quite the grimace.
I think the correct answer to, or the most honest answer to your question is... it came from my dance life.
Okay.
I will say that yoga and dance hold a very similar space in my being. So, like, one is a shade of red and the other is a shade of vermilion. Like, they're so close to being the same entity in my being that it's hard sometimes for me to, like, talk about them interchangeably. But I think it probably really started from my life as a dancer, which I started that when I was 3. So I've done that my entire life.
And you,
did you lead a dance company, or I forget?
No, I've never had my own dance company. I've choreographed, performed in many dance companies, choreographed on kids, I've choreographed on adults, but I never had my own.
Right.
It's a lot of administrative work that I don't want to do.
That's fair. That's fair. For anyone that's even come close to an administrative role or upper management position, you know how awful that is.
So there is a woman, her name is Lori Cawley. She is a dance professor at Union, and she is the artistic director of a very small local dance company called Loose Change Dance Collective, which she started maybe about 10 years ago with the mission of changing the way that we look at aging bodies, aging dancers.
Okay.
There is an unbelievable presence and experience that occurs in an artist from doing year after year after year after year after year. And you don't get it. And it doesn't matter how technically skilled or virtuosic somebody is when they're 20. You just don't get the same gunk that you get from somebody.
I have to appreciate the vernacular in that sense of virtuosic to good gunk. Virtuosic being an inherent skill.
I mean, just a simple lift of a hand can be breathtaking from somebody who's really skilled at what they do. And this is something that Lori really wanted to explore. And it's amazing and it's beautiful. And I think that experience with working with Lori and working with that company really helped me deal with my injury when I first was injured with my arm. And I couldn't even, you were coming to class.
Yeah.
When that happened, I couldn't even put my hand down on the
floor. I remember when you first had the injury, because I was seeing you for one of my injuries, and you're like, listen, I don't know if I can keep working on you because of this. And I remember seeing you in class, and I don't know if other students saw it, because I don't think they have that awareness of what an injury looks like on someone. But I would see you immediately come out of a pose and immediately change how you were teaching the class. It's hard.
It was hard, but thank God I had that. Thank God I had classes to teach that I had to show up to.
Yeah.
Because it became a lifeline. In that headspace, as I was dealing with this injury and not knowing whether it was going to be something that was going to, I was going to rehab and be done within 3 months and everything would go back to normal, or if it was going to be something that was going to stick around with me, I didn't know then. But just so grateful to be able to have a space to go to explore some of those things. And there was some about, today I can put my hands down and table. I couldn't do that last week.
Yeah.
Okay, today I took a breath and down dog with my right hand completely on the mat. I couldn't do that 4 weeks ago. There was those little incremental wins of, yes, I'm figuring something out. I'm seeing progress. then there was this whole other side of, especially with yoga, and I think also dance, it's inherent, where it may not be as inherent as some other forms of movement. There was all this other rich stuff that didn't involve, you know, being really athletic. The breath, the philosophy, the... you know, there's nothing wrong with my legs. I could do a whole bunch of different kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And explore a whole bunch of different stuff because I couldn't rely on my arm. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, I've done a plethora of different types of athleticism, from powerlifting to Olympic lifting to kettlebell training to X, Y, and Z. But the only thing that was, to put it simply, there's nothing like jiu-jitsu where it's, you can be injured and have a very specific training style. Like, I was always a big fan of something called half guard, where it's, you know, important, you don't know, but it's a specific kind of positioning that leads to specific kinds of defenses and attacks. And you know, with my hip injury, I kept to hold half guard, I would yank on my hip all the time, and I would stress the hip flexor, which would pull the hip out of place. So I had to try different avenues of guard playing. And you know, if I had that with that injury, I couldn't keep doing Olympic lifting because either I did the Olympic lift or I didn't. And powerlifting, either I pulled something heavy or I didn't pull something heavy. Even with kettlebells, it's great. I can work around it. I can pick and choose my exercises, but the pathway is limited. But with jiu-jitsu, there is an aspect of learning to control your breath. And that's why I think for someone who is 6'3" and ranging from 280 to 315 pounds, yoga was relatively easy for me to branch into because I had that background in jiu-jitsu of being able to manipulate my body, manipulate my breath, manipulate my level of mental intensity. Because I think in yoga, people don't appreciate you have to be able to accelerate and decelerate your... well, I don't even know how to say it. Your immediate sense of drive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But like you were saying with your shoulder injury, because I have a shoulder injury that's not too different... I stopped going to your classes a little bit because I couldn't even hold down dog without agonizing. And down dog is a rudimentary, basic, relaxing position to be in, and it was causing, only when you do it right.
So, yeah, I mean, when you've been practicing yoga for years and years and years and years, down dog becomes a chillax out in pose.
True.
But
I couldn't hold it for 5 breaths.
Right.
And then I recently started going back to some of your classes maybe a month ago, and I was ecstatic when I had my first chaturanga in that wasn't causing agonizing pain in 2 years.
It's so exciting.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And to everybody else, it just looks like you held a low push-up, the bottom of a push-up, for a second.
Right.
But for me, that was huge.
Right. Because it was so meaningful for you.
Right.
Right.
And it was a metric for how close I was to being able to do the things that I used to do.
I think one of the, I'm not sure what phrasing I want to use, one of the secondary aspects to me continuing to teach yoga while I was working through my injury is that I didn't have the luxury of not showing up to class. I mean, I had to show up. I was the teacher. I had to show up.
Yeah, and you,
I had to
you
show
have to
up
demonstrate.
And I had to do something, right? Whether there were days where I just sat there on the mat and talked, yes. There were days when I did more than that. There were days when I did as much of class as I could. There were days when I did the first 3 minutes and then sat on the mat, you know? But I had to show up, and I had to do something, and I had to figure out how to modify things for my body so that I could be as present as I could for the students who were showing up for me. And I think one of the things we take for granted is the amount of confidence and ballsiness that takes when you are a general participant in a class and you have an injury and you're coming in and you just the balls that it takes to say, I'm going to do today what I need to do for myself.
It's a very difficult.
I'm going to modify the way that I need to. It is difficult, but it shouldn't be. It should be something that is standard.
Yes.
And
I haven't learned that lesson for the record.
Most people haven't.
Yeah.
Most people wouldn't come to class, you know, because, and you know, I get that part of it too, especially if you're paying, and going, what, I'm going to pay $15 to sit in a room and listen to somebody say om? Like, not that that's not a beautiful thing, but that's, you know what I mean? It's a hard pill to swallow. But it's one that we should be more willing to at least consider.
Yeah.
Now, when I was in the real acute phase of my injury and I couldn't put my hand in, down the table, that's not when you go to class. I mean, obviously, that's not when you show up to class. But so many people are afraid to come rehabbing an injury because I think that they don't trust themselves to back off when appropriate. I think
that was part of my problem.
Yeah, because, well, if I can do one, then that means I... Why can't I do 10?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not that... It's not, 1 and 10 are not the same number when you're talking about...
No, I mean, I definitely had that... With yoga, you know, it was like, I know I can do this position, but today it's just not happening,
right.
So I'm gonna make it happen, and then I would be in pain and upset, and then I would be upset the rest of the class,
right?
And I'm pretty confident you picked up on that a few times with the looks you gave me, but it also went with jiu-jitsu. Like, there would be times where I'd be like, I'm feeling okay, let me see what I can do, and then I would get hurt. And be upset and be like, well, now I can't do anything.
Right. And when I say my mindset regarding rehabbing injury came from my dance life, it's because when you're preparing for a performance and you are working through some injury and there's nobody to replace you, and you go into rehearsal and you push that hard so that, I mean, it's not an option. It's not an option to not show up and just be there doing what you can.
Yeah.
Because being there doing what you can today gives you a higher probability of being able to do what you need to do on the stage in front of an audience so that you don't...
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so... There's a ballsiness, but there's also a humbleness at the same time.
Yeah.
Together, yeah.
Yeah, it's not to beat a dead horse, but there is this intense connection between using your body to regulate your mind and using your mind to regulate your body, and you know, you and I have talked about our adventures through the mental health game. can you tell me a little bit about your personal experiences with your mental health journey and how just pushing and like keeping yourself motivated in your PT, your dance life, your yoga life, and where how those two kind of, because I'm sure they weren't always beneficial for each other, but
definitely not.
Yeah.
I
think you know what I'm trying to ask.
I think so. There was a lot of emphasis on responsibility in my household growing up. So if you said you were going to do something, you were expected to do it. Which seems like a silly thing to say, right? Aren't we all kind of raised that way?
Yeah, but not everyone is actually expected to follow through with that.
So, it was very similar in my dance upbringing. You didn't show up to rehearsal. You let the team down. You let everybody else down. It wasn't just, oh, you didn't come today. Here, let's get you catched up.
Yeah, I that's fine. I was going to let it go.
And in extenuating circumstances that would happen if somebody was really sick or whatever, but you know, you did that in a 6-month season, you did that once, maybe twice. You have to show up.
Right.
You have to be there for your friends, for your colleagues. And as well as for your own advancement and understanding and knowledge. But then there are times when the showing up and the taking care of the responsibility that you said that you were going to do is the source of the depression, the frustration, the anxiety, the whatever.
Yeah.
It is. And it didn't occur to me for a very long time that I had the option of just saying no.
I think that's a sentiment a lot of people have varied levels of experience with, yeah.
And it's so hard because the same thing that you get love and joy from and a sense of self from is the same thing that tears you down and makes you feel like you're useless, you know, pointless. Oh, I can't get this pirouette, therefore I might as well just take a shit on the floor. Like, that's where our mind goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you put it in those terms, it's ridiculous, but that's where our mind goes, and it feels so real because you feel like you're letting so many people down.
Yeah.
I don't land this pirouette, I'm letting down the choreographer. I'm letting down my partner. I'm letting down all of these people. And not only that, but it's going to be seen by every single member of that paying audience. They're all going to see that
yeah.
I'm fucked up and now I can't do that. And that I'm letting every single other person down.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'd rather take shit on the floor.
Well, yeah. I think we can all appreciate that mindset, you know? Bombing in a tournament, you know, missing a big lift. Absolutely.
You know, you get older, you grow up a little bit, you experience more things in life. And this is part of what makes those experiences of life so valuable and why somebody who has a long history of performance or experience with something has more wisdom about it.
Yeah.
You realize it doesn't matter if you're perfect or flawless because the probability that you are going to be is not great.
Yeah.
So what are you left with? You're left with, how you deal with that fuck up in that moment. What do you do in that moment when you don't land the turn that you were expected to turn? What do you do in that moment where you fall on your ass instead of land a jump? What do you do in that moment? That's what defines whether or not you flex somebody down or not. Whether or not you are a skilled performer. Whether or not you are a great technician or not a great technician. If you can navigate those moments with grace, nobody fucking knows. Except for the choreographer. Nobody in the audience picks up on it.
Yeah.
And as a yoga teacher, I miscue at least 10 times a class. I say something ridiculous or stupid or don't have any idea which one is my right and which one is my left. Sometimes I can't even remember which is my foot and which is my arm.
I've learned Debonese. And I'm now at the point where I know when a left means a left and left doesn't mean a left.
Right.
Yeah.
And so after like the 900th time I was embarrassed by not knowing my right from my left or miscuing, I realized nobody really cares that much.
No.
It's just not that important whether or not you get all the rights or the lefts correct. And I'm going to tell you, from watching people practice yoga, most of you all don't know your rights from your left either.
That's fair. That's fair. I'm really just mostly stoked when, like, my foot actually lands where it's supposed to land.
Those things in the grand scheme just don't matter as much as we want them to, as we want to make them out to. And when you can accept that, this whole beautiful world opens up to you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's taken a lot of journaling, a lot of really searching and thinking about why I was so unhappy and so depressed and so hard on myself in order to be able to say that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't do it every day all the time. There are times when I still, you know, look in the mirror and say, why would you even get out of bed today?
Oh, I think it's impossible not to self-harm with self-talk and just ruminate on things.
But you just learn with time what's important to spend your energy on and what is just putting lipstick on a pig.
Fair.
No,
I mean, it's a great point, and I have a definite appreciation for how that impacts your athletic life. How has it impacted your personal life? Because, like, on this podcast a lot, we talk about, you know, Chad and I have both been very open about our experiences with, you know, being suicidal and struggling with various parts of our mental health, and we both have this appreciation for taking time out of each day to do one hard thing. And, you know, it's very easy for Chad and I to set almost too high of a bar of what that means. But for some people, it is just getting out of bed. Some people, it is just making sure they eat once that day. And, or, you know, going outside for the first time in a week. You know, how has your mental health journey from the lows to the highs impacted your personal life?
I used to be a raging bitch.
Were you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I just was so miserable in every aspect. I was miserable inside. I was miserable outside.
This must have been before I met you.
Yeah,
or no?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And I distinctly remember just not wanting to be so miserable.
Yeah.
That's when it began to change, when I was like, I don't want to feel this way anymore. I don't want to feel this way anymore. Not, I want to have better relationships with my friends. Not, I want more people to like me. Not, I don't know, I want to get that cute guy over there. None of that. I don't want to feel this way anymore.
Yeah.
And what that sparked within me was this interest in looking at the dark, yucky, disgusting stuff that seemed to exist with me that we're always told don't talk about, don't acknowledge.
Yeah.
I had to start looking at it. I had to. I had to start doing something with it because it was just festering. And I was mean, and I was miserable, and I felt terrible all the time.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can relate to that, where it's, you know,
ABC Sports Fitness?
Yep. Matt was saying that, Matt Donaghy. I don't know why I can't say this today. He was saying, like, with men, we're only allowed to have two emotions, being happy and being angry, and it's not too different with women. It's, you're not allowed to experience other things and address root problems. It's band-aiding everything. And then all of a sudden, we're shocked when shit hits the fan.
Right.
Either we're shocked when our shit hits the fan, or other people are offended and hurt when it happens to us.
Right.
You know?
Okay. I say that I was a raging bitch, and I was a raging bitch, and I was miserable. I don't know that I'm not a raging bitch anymore. I'm just... Number one, I don't always think that being a bitch is a bad thing. Or
we
use that term colloquially is a bad thing. I am confident.
Mm-hmm.
I know my own mind very well. And I really am not going to be told what I can and cannot do with my own life.
Yeah.
And when those values that I have personally, internally, are questioned by another human being, I become a bitch because...
Oh, I've seen you stand your ground. I do not want to be on the receiving end of it.
Me standing
your
ground. I try to remember to be respectful of other people's perspectives, and I would say maybe 68% successful with that.
Fair.
I mean, there's just going to be times where your ego, your emotions are going to take over.
Yeah.
And that's going to happen. That happens with everybody.
Of course.
But I just think that when we accept that we're all assholes sometimes, we're all douchebags sometimes, we all fucking suck sometimes.
Yeah, I would say
it
so.
It happens. Doesn't mean we're terrible people. It doesn't mean that. It means that...
It means that you're actually being authentic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it happens. And it's okay. It's okay that it happens. How you deal with the aftermath is...
It's very easy to make being an asshole or being a bitch or being a douchebag a personality trait, which I think we see a lot.
I think for me, this is a personal perspective, it's the inability to say, I'm sorry.
Oh my God, yes.
That is huge. It's the inability to look somebody in the eye and say, I'm sorry I was an asshole. I know that I was a douchebag.
I have in my position at work, I deal with a lot of kids who have some pretty severe emotional and behavioral issues.
Right.
And I, in my own course of therapy, have adopted the ideology that, you know, you're talking about, and it's definitely not easy for someone who has the level of pride that I do. But I remember in one of my early months of teaching, I went off on this one kid who, come to find out, didn't do anything. He was just, I made him guilty by association of him being around another kid who was doing something stupid. And one of my staff members was like, that wasn't him. He didn't do that.
Right.
And I was just like, okay. And I finished what I was doing with the other kid. And I could tell that the kid that I had yelled at and the staff member both thought that was the end of the conversation with me. Once I had finished dealing with the kid that was actually being the instigator, I came back into the room, stopped, because they were working on a homework assignment, stopped what they were doing and said, hey man, I'm really sorry. I didn't realize that what the situation was, and you didn't deserve that. I apologize. And I could tell, like, as soon as I said that, he was like, okay, yeah, thanks. And like, it was almost an automated response, and I could see it afterwards that he was like, after he said it, then he was like a little confused, like he was not expecting someone, much less an adult, to apologize for being wrong. And you know, we didn't have the smoothest of interactions, which is, you know, expected in my position, but from that point on, he slowly started maybe not respecting me, but appreciating where I was coming from most of things. And it's hard, it's really hard, and people are not used to receiving apologies, especially authentic ones.
Is this an appropriate time to discuss the difference between the word "I'm sorry" and the term "I apologize"?
If you want to share your experiences with that, by all means.
So, to say that you are sorry, that term really means that you empathize with the way that someone is feeling or the situation that they're in. That's why we say, I'm sorry for your loss when somebody dies.
Yeah.
So it's a recognition that you understand how they might be feeling. To apologize means to admit that you were wrong. Literally, that's what it means. I did something wrong. I apologize because I was wrong. Those are different statements. And I don't think people really understand what the word sorry means. They don't understand that it's an empathetic expression.
You know, I talk about this a decent amount on our podcast, where there's a huge difference between sympathy and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
Sympathy is feeling bad for someone, and empathizing is appreciating what they're going through.
Right.
And, you know, that's a big aspect in my pedagogy, so my philosophy of teaching, where it's people are, you know, get a little taken aback when I'm like, I don't feel bad for my kids. You're never going to see me pitying them. I don't feel bad for them. Yeah, their lives suck. I don't feel bad for them. But that's why they respond so well to me, because they're never going to see me pity them.
Right.
because I have high expectations of them. I empathize with what they're going through. I may never know what they're going through truly, but, you know, feeling bad for them is lowering expectations. I'll share in their pain. Very often I'm the one person that they go to.
Right.
But it's because I'm going to reel them back in. I'm going to cue them back to their center of reality, and I'm going to get them back meeting their expectations.
Right. When conflict occurs when there is a difference of perspective and you're sort of jockeying to one up the perspective. Do you know what I mean? Like, my perspective's right, your perspective's wrong, kind of thing.
Yeah. We're constantly trying to validate our positions.
Right.
Instead of just saying, okay, maybe we're both right.
Right. Or by saying, I understand. I hear you. I see you. And that's where the apology, the term I'm sorry, comes a long way in some of that. Just to say, hey, I know I was an asshole. Here's what I was wrapped up in. And I really couldn't, at that moment in time, understand how it was affecting you. But I want to listen to it now.
Yeah.
That's huge. That's huge.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we've both had experiences where people don't want to accept an apology, for one, but don't want to have that conversation.
Well, having that experience with another human being, or experiences, as many of us have had to have it many, many times, is part of what being human is, on both sides of it. Being the person who doesn't want to hear the apology or doesn't want to accept the apology, and also being the person whose apology is accepted. It takes a lot of strength of character to say I'm sorry, but it also takes a lot of strength of character to be the person receiving the I'm sorry.
For sure.
You have to be willing to be vulnerable. And if I'm the asshole, if I was the asshole, which I often am, and I'm coming to you and I'm saying, hey, sorry, you wanna be vulnerable to me now?
Yeah.
It's really hard.
For sure.
Really hard.
Yeah, your guard is up. You've already been hurt by this person. You're gonna be, regardless of how your connection with that person has been prior, you're trying to make sure they don't hurt you again.
It's a lot of deep internal work.
Yeah.
And it's hard to face sometimes. It's hard to do the work. It's hard to recognize that the work needs to be done.
And I think we end up seeing these alternative mindsets to kind of alternative mindsets to having that happen. Like, there's this idea of, well, I'm not going to apologize. I'm not going to say I'm sorry for something that I wasn't wrong in.
Mm-hmm.
Which is cool. You didn't do anything wrong. You may not have meant to hurt someone. You may not have done something malicious. But someone got hurt by your course of actions. You don't need to have an intention. You don't need to be,
a very common thing I see with men is, well, I didn't know. I didn't mean to make someone feel that way. I didn't have this, you know, with the rising awareness of the trans community, I didn't know their pronouns, so I'm not at fault for making that mistake. So I'm not going to apologize. And, you know, that's just a specific example for an an abstract conversation, but it can be anything of, I didn't mean to cut someone off in traffic, so I'm not going to apologize for that, whatever. But it's not about saying you did something wrong. It's about creating reciprocity and healing a connection, even if you don't really know or care about that person.
Right.
You don't have to say you did something wrong.
Right.
It's saying, I'm sorry. Like you said, that's an act of sympathizing or empathizing and creating a connection. And, you know, it takes very little effort to help someone feel less shitty.
It does. I think
it's more about overcoming your own pride in the matter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's allowing yourself to be open to the idea that someone's perspective is different from yours.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. Yeah. I think people come very hardened in their view of the world, and while their view may not be wrong, it doesn't mean it's the singular correct one.
Right, it doesn't mean it's singular.
That's
a great analogy term.
Something.
Description.
Yeah, something. I made it up on the spot, so we'll call it what it is.
Yeah, it's not the only, it's not the only truth. It's not the only reality.
Yeah. You can be a very gentle, you know, soft, you know, kind person.
And still be a pain in the ass.
Or you can be a very, you know, confident, assertive, you know, for lack of a better words, masculine person, and still not be right. And still not be, you know, know instinctively the right way to do things. And it's not even about finding a middle ground sometimes. I think it's just knowing that both are right and both can exist simultaneously.
Exactly.
You don't have to compromise anything.
Correct.
Yeah.
You don't have to compromise anything.
So, yeah. I think that's all I've got as far as questions, unless you have something you want to add on.
I don't think so.
Well, Deb, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to see you again and actually start seeing you in classes again now that I can actually move my body.
It's nice to see you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.